This is Nina Pick, and today is July 7th, 2017. I am here at the Isabella Friedman Retreat Center in Falls Village, Connecticut with Rebecca Arov, and we are going to record an interview as part of the Yiddish Book Center's Wexler Oral History Project. Rebecca, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes.
Thank you. Rebecca, I'm going to start with a couple questions about your family and your childhood. Could you tell me briefly what you know about your family background?
Yeah, in terms of where they lived and are from. So, my mom's side of the family is Jewish, and my grandfather on that side of the family, his family was from Ukraine, Russia, and as was my grandmother's family. His family, he was born here, but his father came here escaping pogroms. And his father was a rabbi, and apparently seven generations back were rabbis on that side of the family. My great-grandmother, her name was Sarah, from my grandfather's mother, her family, I know, owned a inn in, I know my grandmother's family is from Vilna, and I know my grandfather's family was from near where they were from, but I don't know the name of the town. Anyway, my great-grandmother, my grandfather's mother, her family owned an inn. And apparently she, and her mother died when she was young, so apparently she helped run the inn with her father. And a lot of people came in from all different countries and places, and she spoke like five languages, which I always thought was really cool. She kind of has the reputation in our family for being mean, and I think that stereotype and kind of association comes from women who are more strong women. And I remember when I was born, they told my parents wanted to name me Sarah after her, but she was really old, and she said, "Don't name her Sarah, because the angel of death will take her and not me." And so that's why they named me Rebecca. And I always really loved that story about her, because I didn't really know her. She died soon after I was born. But I loved that story because, to me, it shows what some people might call a superstition. But to me, it's more of a belief in magic. And I think that's why people thought she was mean, because I think she was a strong woman. And that she had unresolved feelings about being treated that way and her knowledge not being valued. Because as an older woman, she lived in Atlantic City and hung out and played mahjong with her friends. And I mean, she went swimming every day. She was very, like, physical. And my great-grandfather really had a reputation for being very kind. So that's that side of the family. Both my grandparents lived a very assimilated life. They belonged to a Reform synagogue. But my grandfather's sister, Clara, and her husband, Alex Petkov, they lived in a cooperative building in Philadelphia, and they were very involved with political work. And her best friend and her would like go to protests, and they weren't very religious. As after my grandparents died, I became closer with my Aunt Clara, and I brought a challah and candles to her on one of my first visits after my grandmother died, and she was so happy. She hadn't said the prayers in 50 years, And then I started saying them and she remembered them. And so every time after I came to visit her after that, she was like, are you gonna bring the Shabbat things? And so I always brought them after that. But she, both my grandparents knew Yiddish. They didn't speak it to each other, but they understood it because their parents spoke it among many other languages, apparently. Yeah. Do you want to hear about my dad's side of the family? They're not Jewish.
Sure.
I don't know if that's like interesting for this. Yeah. But I guess what's interesting about my dad's side of the family is all of his siblings like married Jewish people. Well, not all of them, but I do have cousins who are also like part Jewish and part Anglo. His family were like the assholes of this country, basically. I mean, they were like the people, they owned paper mills, and my great-grandfather, they were from Wales and Scotland and Ireland and England and France, and they came over like early and had farms and paper mills. And like my great-grandfather, I guess, invented the hand signs for the stock market and gambled away the family fortune that way. But both of my grandparents, my dad's parents, were in the theater, and my grandmother was an actor, you know, at local community theater, and my grandfather was a stage manager and later a radio station manager.
Thank you. Can you describe the home that you grew up in?
Yeah, I always say I grew up in a small, demented South Jersey town, about 10 minutes from Philadelphia, on a little one-way street with the houses right close up next to each other. We could like talk to our neighbors through the bedroom doors. And it was very assimilated growing up. We would like do high holidays and Passover with my grandparents, but we didn't belong to a synagogue or anything. And what else? We went to Jewish day camp. So that's kind of where I got into being Jewish. And because I was in this public school where there weren't many Jews, and I felt kind of an outsider. And now looking back, I realize it's in part from being Jewish and in part as a queer person. I went to this Jewish day camp, and I didn't have really many friends there most of my years going there in elementary school. And then like my last year there, these two, I guess, popular girls befriended me for some reason. I had known them for years, and they were having bat mitzvahs. So I heard about this for the first time, and I asked my mom if we could join a synagogue and I could have a bat mitzvah. I think it was kind of through the friendship I felt my first kind of sense of belonging with friends, because they were so accepting of me, and I had some idea that they were great, like because they were popular, more people accepted them or something. And I didn't, for the first time, didn't really feel like an outsider. So I wanted to have more of that feeling. So like a year before my bat mitzvah, I got some Hebrew tutoring, started going to this temple. I was like, had to practice a lot. And I had a bat mitzvah. I remember my grandmother cried at my bat mitzvah because I was the first girl in the family who had one, and she was so proud and happy. And then I just went all the way through. Like, I was like, okay, I love this. And I was the kid at Hebrew school that was always arguing, like, is there really God? And like, I just loved, I'm so Jewish. I loved questioning. And I think that stuff was also my parents appreciated that about me. I mean, I know it also annoyed them because I was like, why are we making this rule about this arbitrary thing, you know? But that's something, even though I didn't grow up in a very like religiously Jewish home, there was this way that my mom stood out in the town. Her affectations and her personality are very Jewish, culturally, Ashkenazi. And people didn't like her very much. And people didn't like her very much. My dad's family didn't. I mean, they liked her, but they didn't. There wasn't an ease that I saw between other people, which was a very like WASPy kind of way of relating. Like my mom just had a stronger personality than most women that I was relating with and most people in my dad's family. And so I guess part of me associated that with people not liking her, but I don't know if that was necessarily true. I actually think lots of people did like her, but I felt kind of embarrassed by that. I mean, now I think it's great, but yeah, my parents were married. They're still married. I have two younger brothers. A pretty, like, I don't know, conventional, because there's no such thing as conventional, but I grew up very, like, a very, like, South Jersey middle class life. And I really, like, found a sense of self in Judaism for myself.
So we've been talking a bit about your background, and I know today you're a multidisciplinary artist and a teacher. So I'd like to turn now to a discussion of how you got to where you are today. So let's start with some questions about your history with Yiddish. How would you describe your knowledge of Yiddish?
I mean, it's minimal. I heard words growing up from my grandparents and parents, especially my mom. And then later my great aunt. I've wanted to learn it more before, and learning language is particularly difficult for me. I have an auditory processing disability, which is, I hear fine, but processing information auditorily is challenging. So I mean, I can learn, and it's challenging, yeah. But I felt really drawn to a lot of the theater in Yiddishkeit culture and music, klezmer music, and I felt a sense of familiarity when I hear Yiddish words and use them, and have wanted to bring that more into my art. And also the politics around Yiddishkeit. I think that's probably was like one of the ways that I was most drawn in learning about when I was in college. I went to the Evergreen State College, which is a really alternative college, and I'd gone to this Reform synagogue for Hebrew school and learned all about Israel, and my grandfather's dream was to take his family to Israel, and, you know, he signed up when he was 17 to fight the Nazis, and had a very, like, Jewish nationalistic identity, and just when I was there, when I was 14, I felt very strange. So as an adult, you know, when I was in college, I didn't go to college right after high school, but when I got there, you know, in my early 20s and was learning about, Palestinian struggle, and I also learned about the Bund, and, so that kind of is also part of, like, thinking about language and what disappears and why, and and learning more about Hebrew and learning that Hebrew, when Hebrew was created as a modern language, that they chose to use a French accent, which to me, I was like, that's so strange and racist, really, because here's Israel existing in amongst Arab countries, so why wouldn't there be an Arabic accent if there were to be picking an accent? Just thinking of like Yiddish pronunciation versus modern Hebrew pronunciation and how my family said words, and then when I was in Hebrew school, how I was taught to pronounce words, I feel like something got missed. And for me, and it also has made me really curious about other Jewish languages too, and what got missed there. It's like such a rich culture of language. So I'm still interested, and I'm still interested politically in like this idea, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it correctly, but Doikait, which is an idea that came out of the Bund of Here-ness, was what it translates to, and of if you're here, and you know, if you're living in a nation, and there were indigenous people to that place, there are people who currently live in that place, and as a Jew in diaspora, I just need to be here where I am, is my sense. And I think that's a lot of like my identity as a Jewish artist, is as a Jewish artist in diaspora. And that's really informed a lot of my work and a lot of my political work too. And you know, if my identity is of a person in diaspora and I don't have a land to go home to per se, and I don't ascribe to Israel in that way, then you know, what does that mean about how I live my life and how I've come to feel what that means for me is to do solidarity work with indigenous people on the land that I live in. Currently, I live in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, so working with the Lishan people, who are Europeans called Ohlone people, more commonly known as. And I mean, that work's like been so transformative for me to do that work, and for me to feel a sense of home and here-ness and presence when I acknowledge that and do work to support the people who are indigenous to the land that I'm living on. I have more to say on that. I don't know if
yeah, okay. Go ahead. Yeah, please.
Yeah, I'm curious about Jewish identity and anti-Semitism, particularly. And I'm in the current political climate. We're living in a time where to criticize the state of Israel is thought of as anti-Semitic. Any work that exists culturally for Jews or spiritually for Jews that's separate, that just exists in it of itself, to me, in a way, is solidarity work with Palestinians. You know, that would be like a mild way. I of course see solidarity work being much, much more involved than that. But there's this way that I think about bringing my cultural, because I am a Jew living in diaspora, bringing my cultural gifts to the land that I am a settler on is a way to bring healing to the land that I'm on, because if I don't have a home to go home to, land that I'm indigenous to, then I have a responsibility, it feels, to share the gifts of my culture and the spiritual technologies of my culture. It's a connecting with the gifts that exist, and I do that through my art.
Yeah. So you're the creator of the Moon Angel Tarot deck, which integrates Yiddish words along with the art and the text in English. Could you tell me a bit about the Moon Angel deck?
Yeah, I actually have it right here, which you asked me to bring. This is the Moon Angels Malach Halavana Oracle deck, and that's the only Hebrew in the deck, which means Moon Angels. And yeah, this came out of my work during my time being trained as a Kohenet Hebrew priestess. And I was really interested in connecting with the cycle of the moon and a learning that I latched onto, that when you have a feeling, it's an angel visiting you. And I really liked this teaching because it felt very non-patriarchal to me in a society that often tells us to disregard our feelings. I liked the idea of a feeling being an angel visitation. And honestly, before that, I don't even think I knew that angels were a part of Judaism. You know, since then, learned more about that. But I latched onto this idea, and I felt that being connected to the cycle of the moon, I was more able to navigate and express my own feelings. And to me, there's a feeling connected with Yiddish for me, and it's a feeling of connection to my ancestors. And I think about their stories and their feelings and the ways that they expressed themselves. And so I asked my friend Ana Elena Torres to translate the titles of the cards into Yiddish. And I really like that. I really like when I pick a card, I often will say the title out loud in Yiddish to evoke a feeling of connection to my ancestors. And I like it because it's very intuitive and intuitive and undefined in what it means per se, besides the connecting feeling. But it does feel like a way of honoring who came before, and also honoring that, you know, my ancestors gave me the gift of my life and give me a lot of inspiration in my day-to-day life that I can't even track or understand, which is a lot like the cards. You know, I made the art very intuitively. Should I hold up some of them?
Please.
Here you can see the backs of them here. And here's some of the fronts of them.
Could you provide an example of one of the readings as well?
Sure, I'll do the first one. Oh, or maybe I'll do, where is it? Okay. I'll do two of them. So I'll do the ancestors card, which is the first one. And the Yiddish is Avosenu. Whispers in the ear, deja vu, butterfly kisses, footprints in the sand, train whistles, the smell of garlic, after dark, clanging bells, handkerchiefs. So the idea is to pick one and let it kind of, you know, pick one to start your day or before you go to bed and reflect on synchronicities or imagery that comes up related to it. And it's different than, you know, you might have heard of tarot decks. I call it an oracle deck because it's trusting the oracle within yourself to make the connections. And yeah, also often I'll pick them around the moon time, different phases of the moon, you know, the new moon for setting intentions, the full moon, or for letting go and then setting intentions is kind of more of the new moon, and the full moon for thinking about what you want to make full in the world. I also wanted to share this other card because it's just really great. So this is the Go card, and in Yiddish it's Gay, and loved that. So that card says, reach out, reach, reach, go, go, stretch. It will blow your mind and your body. Your mind is going to blow the fuck open. Your body is not gonna believe this shit. Go, go, get it. Obviously, I'm completely irreverent with language in some ways, and completely reverent in others. But, you know, that's kind of what it is to be gay in a lot of ways, to be queer, is going for it. And finding meaning and making meaning within Judaism for ourselves. Yeah.
That's a great segue to one of my next questions. What do you see as this connection between queer culture and Yiddish culture?
I mean, all of my friends who are into Yiddish are queer. So there's got to be something there. I think that as a queer person, we experience an amount of stigmatism in our lives, depending on our history, and oppression, and that can, and for many of us, does end up helping us have compassion for other people who have experienced stigmatism. And we've had to identify, use an identity, naming ourselves. We've had to name ourselves in order to find each other and in order to transcend those names. And when you have to identify yourself, you want to know, I think, often about other parts of your identity as well. And so I think that leads many of us, I can speak for myself, to wanting to understand where I come from. And that includes Yiddish culture. And there's this particularity around the politics around Yiddish culture and socialism and anarchism that I think many queers are also drawn to, because we've felt, either as Jews or as queers or both, that there's this sense of wanting to I think one of the things is wanting to make comedic that which has made the stereotypes that have been made against us. So if you know, someone's making some stereotype against me for being queer, you know, I think it's very queer to turn that on its head and kind of play it out even more. And I think that's also true in Yiddish theater, of stereotypes of Jews and then kind of playing those out even more. So in the arts, there's an interest, particularly, I think, as a queer Jewish artist.
What, if any, is the role of Yiddish in your work more broadly?
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I guess I can think about it a little bit more. I think it is important, actually, to identify, because it's drawn me to other artists who are interested in working with Yiddish, and it's helped forge connections with other artists, and Jews, yeah, and, like, for example, learning songs, you know, sharing Yiddish songs at Shabbat with other queer Jews, and yeah, an interest in it. Yeah, and an interest in using some of the words as, you know, reclaiming words like Vegela and Zaftig, and that those, you know, similar to queer English words, you know, reclaiming like dyke or queer, or, yeah.
And you mentioned that you came to your work with the Moon Angel deck while you were studying to be a Kohenet. Could you tell me a bit about what a Kohenet is?
Yeah, Kohenet is it's called a Hebrew Priestess Institute, and it's a training program, and it's a community, kind of using ancient Jewish practices, bringing them into a more modern context, and I got people, I mean, I don't know if this is resonant for people listening, but using feminism and using earth-based Judaism put into practice in ritual and community. That would be a short answer. Yeah.
And what is the role of divination tools in Jewish culture more broadly?
I mean, I think people have always used divination tools. Like, I really think my grandmother used divination tools. I mean, I also heard her say, there was also a story about her saying, don't step on cracks in the sidewalk, you know? And that's a, like, common thing people say, don't step on a crack, break your mother's back, you know? Well, it came from somewhere. And I'm super curious about the origins of that. And I also love the superstition about naming, too, that the idea that there's some divine moving in the world, and that how we call ourselves has power, and that there's some energy or divine moving in the world that acknowledges and connects to that power. What was the question again?
The role of divination in Jewish culture. Is there particular link to a Yiddish cultural history that you know of?
I'm not thinking of anything, but I feel like in lots of Yiddish stories, there are, you know, the golem and, like, you know, different figures and characters, and that feel very much about magic, and that's part of my interest in it as well. I'm not thinking of anything per se, but I think so.
Thank you. Could you tell me a bit about your current project?
Yeah, I am currently working on a film called Queer Mikvah, a Jewish water ritual, working title. But it's a film and a project, and I never had any aspirations of making a film. It kind of just was a natural unfolding. So I have been interested in mikvah, which is a Jewish ritual of water immersion, where you fully immerse yourself in water without touching anything else. And a lot of the tradition is around going back to how you were in your birth state and in the womb, which, you know, that framing of it could be really useful for maybe someone who was born intersex, of who had their body changed without their consent, of, you know, that you were made exactly as God made you. And it could also be hurtful for someone who has decided to change their body, identifies as transgender or genderqueer, and saying, like, that's the only way to go back to how you were when you were born. So the idea of queer mikvah is really to frame this ritual as it's meaningful to yourself, and to use the part of the tradition that speaks to you personally. And it's also about making it accessible, and both physically accessible and just known about as a ritual that you could do. And because queers have been excluded from traditional mikvah space. So, you know, a mikvah is a natural body of water. It could be a lake or the ocean, but it also, as most people know about, it's, you know, some kind of pool or tub in a synagogue often. And you kind of go, and it's very gendered. And according to law, it's gendered. But the queering of it is saying anyone can enter this. How are we going to find spaces where it is possible to enter? And there are a couple projects that are specifically working on that. There's a place outside of Boston I haven't gotten to visit yet called Mayim Haim. And they are particularly focused on making the mikvah space available to people with disabilities and trans and genderqueer people who haven't been able to access in other ways. There's also a project called Immerse NYC in New York City that's training people to be mikvah guides, and also looking about how to create space in New York area for queer people. And the idea of the film, it came from, you know, my interest in this ritual, and I've been interested in it for a long time. Like when I did this farming fellowship at Isabella Friedman here, called Adama, and I remember, like, the first week it was Shabbat, and they were like, okay, it's time to do mikvah. And so we went down to the river, and they said, okay, men go over there and women go over there. And I was like, we need a third option, because I identify as genderqueer, and what about other people here may as well have needs around this. But it was great because, you know, the program actually really integrated that after that, at that point. And it really was my first claiming of that ritual for myself, because I was able to put it in a context that worked for me. Over the years, the ritual was revived for me recently through my friend Orav Katz in Kohenet a couple years ago, and who was doing a project around mikvah in Toronto, queer mikvah in Toronto. And we just started having a lot of conversations and collaborating in a way together, And I started writing grants for to do queer mikvah and to, you know, I was had all these ideas of like public installation and bringing these thing, this queer mikvah that I just did with my friends spontaneously, not formalized, you know, that I'd been doing for a decade, bringing it to a more public context and bringing it, as I was saying before, as a gift of my culture to the land that I was living on. But I wrote a lot of grants and I didn't get any of them. So I thought, I need to show people what I'm talking about, like that they need to see what this thing is that I'm trying to create for more broader access. And so I thought, okay, I should make like a little film about it, just like a 5-minute film. And I actually was working on a promotional video for my deck, and the person that I found, Johnny Bockwinkle, to work on the promotional video for the deck, I said to her at the beginning, I have this idea for doing this other film about queer mikvah. And she said, okay, well, let's see how it goes for this promo video. And it was a really great experience, because it was like, people have no idea. I had no idea what goes into film. And making this like 40-second promo video was like 400 hours of work. So I got a taste of what, you know, and of course, like something like a commercial, really quick shots and lots of different shots is going to be different than making a full-length film. But I did get a taste of the amount of work that would go into doing something like that. But I really loved it. And so after we finished that and it turned out great, I said, hey, do you want to start working on this other project? And so it's been, you know, we've been working on it for like 4 months now. And we've done a bunch of interviews, I facilitated the creation of 3 formalized rituals of queer mikvah, and learned a lot along the way. Like the first one we did in solidarity with Standing Rock, and the things that were recently coming up, it was in the beginning of March, so around immigration, and I facilitated it. And afterwards I was like, no, it's too much to direct and produce this event and have it be filmed and then also be facilitating. So the next one I asked a couple, and the spirit of it is to do it in community. Like I didn't want to just like make a film about me facilitating these queer mikvah experiences, you know. So for the next one, I invited, you know, I asked a couple friends if they wanted to do it. Kat Cunningham, who's doing the Gay Bathhouse Project in Seattle, and my friend, who actually we just got connected through another mutual friend. We didn't even know each other. And then also my friend Dory Midnight, and who is a wonderful artist and ritual leader. And so I asked both of them, because we were both going to be at the Jewish Voice for Peace National Member Meeting in Chicago. And, you know, we planned the ritual together, and then we held it at the pool at the hotel. And, it didn't follow the guidelines of having natural water in it, you know, rainwater or anything like that. It was a chlorinated pool straight from the faucet, you know. But to me, you know, that works for me. It wouldn't work for a lot of people I know, and it wouldn't work for a lot of queer people I know. But it was nice to intend it to be that, and I, for one, experienced a kind of transformation. And for me, it was more around like planning the whole thing, and but then the actual moment of emerging, and also that in that, you know, in these, and then we did one in for Pride in at Baker Beach in San Francisco, in the nude area, which is known for being like a nude gay beach, a few weeks ago. And that was amazing. That I learned from that, I don't actually want to be one of the facilitators at all. So I instead, you know, kind of curated a group of people. You know, I did a general call out first to people who I thought would be interested. And then kind of not many people were, you know, people in the Bay Area were like so busy. So I asked individual people, and it ended up to be this group of artists. And so a lot of art got incorporated into the mikveh, and it was beautiful. One of the artists, Lucasa Bramfin Verencino, did a object mikveh, where she asked people to bring objects and then kind of made them into an art piece and poured water over them. Nikki Green, who's she's many things, but a sculptor. She made pickles and did a pickle blessing for everyone, a fermentation blessing, thinking about how the pickle changes in the brine with the salt, like us going into the water, the ocean going into the ocean, changing our bodies through that, through the mikveh and the ocean. And Remedios Martinez Cantu also facilitated the whole ritual. And, you know, that was just, she did such a beautiful job facilitating our personal and then thinking of the larger political collective healing that needs to be happening around queers, around Black Lives Matter, around Palestinian solidarity. And the project's happening, and I'm writing grants for it now, and now we have a trailer. And it's just magical how things are unfolding, because more people are kind of coming out and are interested in it, and I think it's speaking to a lot of people. I feel like the intention of the film is both to create these mikveh experiences, and, you know, we also want to document some of what's happening at Mayim Chaim and Immerse NYC and the Gay Bathhouse, and Orav Katz is also doing another project in Toronto this fall related to mikveh. But, and I'm sure there are many people doing many other wonderful queer mikveh things, other places I have no idea about. But kind of a, like, give an example of, this is a way that you can queer a ritual and make it meaningful to yourself, and like, go do it. Go do it with your people and your community, and take other rituals and do that too. And like, use rituals in the Jewish community, but then use rituals of your own culture if you're not Jewish. And like, there's a way to queer spirituality to make things meaningful. And I think it's just kind of like knowing it's out there, mm-hmm. you know, to create kind of sometimes enough to empower people to bring that into their lives. And I mean, not that people aren't doing it everywhere and haven't always done it too, but I think the more public we make these things, the more permission we have to do them more.
Great, thank you. So I know you had a strict time frame. We're coming to our end of our time, so I want to say thank you so much, Rebecca,
yeah.
And on behalf of the Yiddish Book Center and personally.
Thank you. It's an honor.
Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview from the Yiddish Book Center's Wexler Oral History Project. To learn more, visit yiddishbookcenter.org.